Welcome to the Business Resilience Decoded podcast, brought to you by Aspalis Advisors and the Disaster Recovery Journal. Crisis management in today's world is ever-changing, and this podcast is our commitment to help you navigate successful outcomes for any crisis you may face. I'm your host, Vanessa Matthews. I specialize in providing insights and solutions for crisis, continuity, and resilience across industries from real estate and healthcare to terrorism in the airline and transportation worlds. No matter what industry you're in, this podcast will provide you the tools to build resilience in your organization. Welcome back to another episode of the Business Resilience Decoded podcast. I am your host, Vanessa Matthews. Last week, the Supreme Court ruled against affirmative action, making it illegal for higher education institutions to consider race as a factor in admissions. Affirmative action has helped counteract the unconscious biases of admissions teams and institutions across the country, just as DE&I efforts are a part of hiring have helped people to widen the fields to qualified candidates of all races and genders and ethnicities. Rolling back affirmative action is a huge step backwards and has already led to fair arguments about how legacy admissions tend to favor wealthy white candidates and therefore should be eradicated as well. I hope one of the takeaways you've gotten from our podcast is that we all benefit from colleagues with diverse perspectives and experiences, because diversity is more than skin deep. But when we let the biases we've collected throughout our lives take the wheel when it comes to hiring, we lose the opportunity to invite diverse candidates to the table. Losing affirmative action could mean fewer students of color in emergency management and business continuity programs, which means a less diverse workforce for years to come. And it already wasn't really diverse to begin with. In this episode, we're going to share clips from our past episodes on higher education, from the experience of leaders and students at historically Black colleges and universities to the future of security and DE&I efforts on college campuses. We hope this episode spotlights the forward progress we've seen in higher education. The first spotlight is from episode 103 of the podcast with Kimberly Ballard Washington, the former president of Savannah State University. In this clip, she talks about the future of HBCUs and how the campus was preparing for the possibility of a bomb threat, which was happening at HBCUs across the country. How should HBCUs be approaching threats like bomb threats that we've seen across the country from both a campus morale and an emergency preparedness perspective?
So it's important that we continue to a certain extent business as usual. Morale-wise, we've got to make sure that our students, staff, and faculty feel safe and know that the powers that be, security teams, really, are working and thinking about our safety at all times. That helps with the morale. But we also have, we can't stop programmatic activities. That's not the way to limit. College should feel and look like college. Mm-hmm. And so we're working to make sure that, that has occurred. We have taken some measures to make it less likely that any threats would be true. We don't know, of course, you can't stop someone from making a threat, but what we want to do is stop the likelihood of a bomb being placed on our campus or bringing some certain damage. And so we've worked with various professionals, FBI included, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, Homeland Security, and even some private companies have come in to assist us in making sure that we have thought clearly about what we need to do to protect our infrastructure, but also our campus way of life.
I can appreciate that. You talked a little bit about equity and I can imagine that it's frustrating, but it also probably feels like it's just always something. And so I can appreciate with the multiple hats that you have to wear, but also in leveraging the expertise from your external partners, in addition to what do we do to keep our people safe, has got to be a dynamic, as well as to help, you know, to help students explain, well, why are we a target and what does this mean? I can imagine that those are very honest and vulnerable conversations.
Those definitely are. You know, being a target is never comfortable and no one wants to feel like they are a target. This, what happened in January, February, with all of the bomb threats being focused at HBCUs and, you know, in churches, synagogues, all that was happening simultaneously and very disconcerting. And mm-hmm. so a lot of populations were feeling the pressures surrounding that, you know, when will it be us? Yeah. For those of us that didn't receive, that was the question that we were asking, when? And moving to what do we need to do so that it won't be us?
Yes.
And that's really the key. We want to make sure that we're protecting and not just preparing for the inevitable. We want to protect our constituency. You know, one of the things you hear all the time is that safety is our number one priority. It is, but really education should be. Safety should just be, it's incidental to what we do as a business. Safety has to be a concern that we're always engaged in, but that priority still has to be maintained as education. And absolutely. How do you educate in a safe environment? So that's the key.
Next, we're throwing it way back to episode 55, where we spoke to Philip Johnson about campus safety in light of civil unrest and protests and our thoughts on defunding the police.
Great. Two words, defunding the police. I guess that's three. And I was with a group of friends a while back, probably 2 or 3 months ago, when those conversations started to come up. And we were all African-Americans and it was 15 of us. And none of us could agree on what defunding the police meant.
Well, therein lies the critical importance of all to be having dialogue, to be listening, to be trying to come together around this issue. You know, and you have to be careful about our reaction to that. I mean, on its face, we might just say, well, that's just crazy. We can't defund the police. We need the police. I appreciate the police will come and help me in an emergency. But how we police, the defund police means much, much more.
Yes.
And we all need to have a dialogue around that. And we need to do that in our communities, in our neighborhoods. And, you know, I remind people in America, we're a republic. We get to be the police because people say we could be the police when we're policing.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What do you think about how defunding the police, which from my understanding, it's about taking use of force resources and reallocating those dollars to other parts of the community that need them more, like education. What are your thoughts in terms of how the concept of defunding the police would impact higher education campus public safety?
I think that the model there is a bit different from our municipal and county counterparts. I think as, you know, you look at cities in general, they're going to be spending well over 50% of their budgets in public safety areas, probably. And that is not true in higher education. So I think the impact will be around defunding the police is connected to issues like use of force and accountability and how we respond to complaints and how we prioritize values. So defunding police means a lot of different things to a lot of people. It's going to have a greater impact if, you know, you say we're going to eliminate police positions, mm-hmm. we're going to make cuts in the police budgets in a city or a county. I hear chiefs and sheriffs saying, I'm going to go to training. That's going to be one of the things that's cut first. And that seems to me to be really bad because that's probably the thing we need most. The other thing is if layoffs happen, they're typically first in or last in, first out. So all the efforts of the recent years that have brought us somewhat greater diversity in many departments would see us losing the officers that may be bringing the greatest promise for cultural changes in police service.
Last year, in episode 118, we spoke with Dr. Karen Lindsay from Elon University about her work teaching strategic communications through a DE&I lens. In this soundbite, she shares why DE&I efforts should not just come from a committee. They should have investment from the very top of the food chain.
So I know that you have a strong niche in higher education, although you've worked in several different industries. Where are you seeing companies get wrong when it comes to strategic communications and DE&I?
Yeah, I think there is a report by my former employer that I absolutely adore, and it is it's the Edelman Trust Barometer, but it is a sub-report on social justice and how that's gone over the past several years, particularly, you know, with the 2020 2021 highlighting of, oh, this is a thing now. And so I think that with that movement has come this idea of what companies need to do. And once again, we've been talking about it for years, but I think that we've never had a way to operationalize it. And so what I see companies doing wrong is putting together committees and employee resource groups. And I'm all for doing those, but guess what? We all know, she's laughing hysterically, it needs to come from the top. And so I'm all about, which is why I won't take on a client unless I can talk to the CEO or president of the university. If your HR person comes to me and says, hey, Dr. Lindsay, we'd like to hire you to do some consulting. I'm like, that's great. When can I get a meeting with your CEO or the president or, you know, of the university or chancellor, whomever is really setting the strategic plan and goals for the institution or organization? So I think what companies are getting wrong is that if the CEO or top executive is a little nervous about entering into this conversation or this space, they say, well, okay, we still need to do it. So let HR do it or let some employee resource group do it. And so my thought is what we're getting wrong is that it's the commitment from the top. And nothing I'm saying here is new information, but every day I go into organizations or every time I go into organizations, I see this as the issue. What is the top leader saying about it? And then how is that embedded throughout your strategic goals and priorities? And so that's what I often talk to organizations about. Those organizations that are doing something moving forward, I think those are the ones that have the strongest voice with their top executive, not just the vice president of diversity and inclusion, not just the vice president of HR, but your top decision maker, along with if they're in a public organization, they have a board, the board is supportive. Like there's all those power structures that are supporting, we need to do this. And here are some places we can enter into it.
Our last clip is another throwback from episode 54, where I interviewed Destiny Ruffin, one of my mentees, about her experience as a Black woman graduating from a historically Black college into the field of emergency management. And I also shared some of my own experiences as a Black female in this industry.
82% of emergency managers are white males. And our last podcast or a couple podcasts ago, Chauncey Willis talked about those data and statistics coming from the Department of Labor. And so I've had my own experiences of working in a predominantly white field as a Black face, a Black woman, and being under the age of 50. I always tell people there's three things that can work for me or against me. It just depends on where I'm at, right? And so when you think about those numbers in emergency management, can you talk about your experiences as a Black woman transitioning into emergency management from an HBCU? What did you observe?
Well, things of that nature? Well, I will say this. I'm not sure with your degree, when you were doing your degree, but when I was doing my degree program, it kind of got a little diverse. I'm going to say that because a lot of my classmates were already in the military or already in law enforcement. So we had a kind of a balance. We had people who were, you know, actually just going into college. Then we had people who were already in established careers. So early on, I realized that a lot of people from the public safety sector were actually getting into it. So I kind of got a familiar that possibly I might be one of the only ones in the room. So when I transitioned into being an intern and I would go to all the meetings with my director, everyone would look at me like I was a unicorn. It was like, she's your intern? They're like, yeah, she's our intern. She actually has a degree in emergency management. So I think for me, it was an eye-opener for me because coming from an HBCU, you know, you're used to the people you're used to seeing. And when you go into the transition for emergency management, you don't see anybody look like you. Like, I was just grateful that at the time, our deputy director, she was a Black female. And she was a Black one. She was very strong. And I remember her giving me those conversations like, you're going to be in training or you're going to be in a meeting and you're going to be the only one that looks like you. Mm. How are you going to feel comfortable? Are you going to be guarded? Are you going to be a shining star? Or what are you going to do? And how are you going to be able to handle it? Because you're not going to be able to handle it. This field is not for you. Let me know that very, like, to prepare me for, there's a possibility that somebody might not look like you. So are you going to be able to stand in front of them and actually teach them or tell them what you know? Or are you going to freeze up? So
yeah.
It's definitely an experience.
The early part of my career was in emergency management, and Atlanta Fulton County was the second agency that I worked at. And then I went over to the corporate world. And I would say that what I would have preferred my HBCU to teach me was how to maintain my own confidence when I'm in an environment where people do not value me, where people don't give me the opportunity to speak up, and more importantly, when I am being led by a manager who's not invested in me, because their own upbringing, they may not have ever had to value diverse or minority people. And so those were some of the obstacles that I had to go through in corporate America and in the government sector. And so those are a couple of things for me that shine light on that. And major thanks to Pansy Ricks. I worked with her as well, and I know she's amazing. And representation matters. So to your point, in the city of Atlanta, Black people are normal in business. And it's not a surprise. And so everybody kind of looks like you. We call it Chocolate City. And so that's an amazing place when you can go to work and you see people in leadership who look like you, because it tells you that you belong.
I hope this episode sheds some light on the issue. And if you have any questions about what's going on with the SCOTUS ruling, I invite you to leave a comment on our LinkedIn post for the episode. And maybe we'll do a Q&A in a future episode. All the links to the full length episodes will be available in the show notes. Thank you for listening. I'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to the Business Resilience Decoded podcast, brought to you by Asphalus Advisors and Disaster Recovery Journal. Make sure you check out the show notes for this episode to see all the upcoming events, programs, and ways we can support you. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, leave us a review, and share it with a friend. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you in the next episode.